That's Clifford Brown starting out on Jordu from the album Clifford Brown and Max Roach, released in 1954. Harold Land also on tenor, saxophone, George Morrow on bass, Richie Powell on piano, Max Roach on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Tuesday, May the 27th. And today we get an update. We begin where we left off from the first installment by our correspondent on this issue, Paul DiRienzo, an investigative reporter who, under a grant from the Polk Awards Journalism, has begun a series on the Hanford site, America's Fukushima. And he was talking in the first installment, giving us some background about the Hanford site on the Columbia River in south central Washington state, where it was built in 1943 and operated for many years, 40 plus years, this nuclear site that produced the nation's first plutonium production reactor. In fact, it was the world's first production reactor that produced much of the nation's nuclear arsenal, including the bombs dropped on Japan. The operation in that time, however, has been a catastrophe, an ecological catastrophe, and he talked about that. It's 586 square miles on the Columbia River, and 9 nuclear reactors were engaged in this production process. But in those years, from World War II and throughout to the Cold War, and even now, they're still partially operating, nuclear waste has seeped into the water, into the air, into the soil, and is now and has been the largest ecological catastrophe in the United States, akin to that of Fukushima, Japan, in the aftermath of the tsunami that hit. So, Paul DiRienzo, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you very much, Utrice.
Well, you take it where it is you want us to go.
Well, I'll start by reminding listeners that Hanford on the banks of the Columbia River was where two-thirds of the plutonium produced by the United States was manufactured between 1943 and the last reactor, the N reactor, was shut down, finally decommissioned around 1991. During that time, millions and millions and millions of gallons, tons, and cubic feet of waste were dumped into without any sort of protection or any consideration, really, at first for the environment. It was just really dumped in reverse wells. They would dig a well deep into the ground and just dump the waste directly into the soil. They would often dump it directly right into the river. The coolant was taken for 8 of the 9 reactors. The coolant water was taken directly out of the river, passed through the reactors to cool these mega massive reactors that were built, and then dumped directly back after a short waiting period to allow some of the worst radioactivity to decline directly back in the river. Also, smokestacks dumped huge amounts of radioactive iodine and other radioactive substances into the atmosphere. So there were 3 vectors of dosage, and that's what they call it, a dosage of radiation, to the workers and to the residents as well as the environment. After a while, the amount of radiation being dumped into the environment really became so large and frightening even to the people doing it that they started to put them in tanks. Similar to what's happening in Fukushima, where the water, groundwater, which is polluted, they try and put it into these very large tanks that were built on the property, holding them until sometime in the future when they figure out what to do with them, what to do with all this irradiated waste. Currently, there are 177 tanks, 60 million gallons of radioactive waste. Enough to easily, not just radioactive waste, but chemical waste. It's believed that every single known element to man in its radioactive form, as well as its regular form, is contained within those tanks. It is absolutely unknown exactly what is in the tanks, which is at the heart of the problem in Hanford, because at Savannah River, which is in South Carolina, where also where the hydrogen bomb project was developed, and where also plutonium, about one-third to the two-thirds at Hanford, one-third of the plutonium was manufactured on the Savannah River in South Carolina, and that's the other large cleanup site that's very large and very polluting, and that's a big concern for people in South Carolina. And the South Carolina site initiated a program to deal with their waste called vitrification, which is vitrify means to make something into glass, a form of glass. The vitrification is glass making. And so they actually take radioactive waste, mix it with silicon and other chemicals, and they turn it into glass logs, which hopefully stabilize for the thousands of years. Some of these radioactive isotopes can decay in a short period of time and still very dangerous, even if they decay in 8 days. During those 8 days when people ingest them, they could get exposure radiation that could cause cancer, you know, decades from now. But some of the radioactive waste, like certain plutonium isotopes, can stay radioactive for a quarter million years or longer. And so what the idea is to take them and make them into glass, and then one day find, because there right now is no repository for the WIPP plant, W-I-P-P, in Carlsbad, New Mexico, is now the government's defense waste or authorized defense waste repository. It's an underground salt mine outside of Carlsbad, New Mexico. And in February, there was a unreported fire and explosion within the WIPP, and plutonium was released into the environment, and dozens of workers were ingested some of it. And the smallest little microscopic speck of plutonium can cause lung cancer. It's one of the most poisonous substances ever developed by humans on Earth. And it has no purpose really on Earth. And the public was not informed. And the people in the area around Carlsbad, a very poor area of the country, Washington State, which is much today, you know, is a wealthy state, refused to allow Hanford to be turned into a permanent repository, which was the first idea. So there's two types of waste, commercial and non-commercial waste. Commercial waste tends to be highly radioactive and small amounts of it, and it's by law must be kept underwater in pools of water, as it was in Fukushima, which water is actually a very good shielding for radiation. They keep it in water, but the problem is if the water boils away or somehow evaporates or is dissipated, the fuel that's kept in there will just keep heating up hotter and hotter and hotter, and then possibly be released into the environment, as happened in Fukushima. It was a very good system until the system was hit by a tsunami. In the United States, you're not allowed by law to move that waste. Waste cannot be moved in the United States without a permitted place for it to go. The entire trip from taking the waste from point A to point B has to be permitted every step of the way. So it is not very easy. There is very little nuclear waste ever moved in the United States by law. However, defense waste is interesting. Defense waste is a huge amount, much more than commercial waste, but it tends to have lower radioactivity. The defense, you know, so you're talking about, you know, you have to understand that when radiation gets on something, it stays on that thing. So if you have a glove on and you touch something that's radioactive, your glove is radioactive. If you touch something with a doorknob with that glove, then the doorknob you touched is radioactive. If somebody comes behind you and touches that doorknob with another glove, then their glove is radioactive. So the radiation actually spreads by contact. So what they have is the Defense Department, unlike the commercial, the defense reactors and defense nuclear industry, like nuclear reactors for submarines and things like that, is like a huge amount of like garbage that needs to be disposed of. So the idea was to dispose it. They had to have a place to dispose it, so they decided to pick a salt mine in New Mexico. Now, Washington State refused to allow Hanford to be the repository. The repository was going to be, again, at the nuclear site, the test site in Nevada, where they tested the atom bombs at Yucca Flats, Yucca Mountain. Yucca Mountain was the government, the Congress said, no, you can't do it in Yucca Mountain. There's a tremendous earthquake risk there. It's right near Las Vegas. So they went around and they found a poor state. It's always either Arkansas or New Mexico or Mississippi, the poorest states, the ones that are desperate for any sort of income at all, that are approached by the government, and they are told this is going to be safe. There's not going to be any problems. You're going to just get money, and jobs are going to be flooding into your state with this project. So the poor people of Carlsbad, when every other state that could get money doing anything else, I mean, in Washington State, they sell marijuana. It's legal. You know, you take tax money from marijuana rather than take radiation. They rather legalize marijuana than take radiation. I'm not, that's not even a joke, because when I was up there, that's what people were telling me. New Mexico took the waste. So in February, they're told it is safe. It's deep down, thousands of feet down in a geologically stable salt mine. And sure enough, nearby is fracking. Now, have you talked about fracking on your show at all? Yes. There's fracking going on in New Mexico. The fracking, the explosions underground in order to release the natural gas, allowed cracks to open and water to seep into the supposedly geologically stable forever salt mine that they hollowed out under Carlsbad. When the water got in there, a chunk of the roof fell on top of a bunch of tanks containers, sealed containers full of plutonium contaminated waste. Then the whole process of putting the waste they repackage. I saw them doing this in Hanford. They actually take the waste. They're still packaging the waste. They take it from these old 1940s and 50s era packages, which are unlabeled, uncomputerized. Nobody knows what's in them. They open them up in this room, the poor workers, they're desperate for work, and they're terrified by the work they do. And they're taking the substances, the gloves, the smocks, the boots, the tools, all the stuff that was, quote-unquote, crapped up. Crapped up means that you got radiation on you if you're crapped up. So that was the term they used. If it was crapped up, boy, you're in trouble. And I talked to some of these old guys who were the radiation detectors, and if they, as you came out of work, they would run a wand over you. If they saw you had radiation on your clothes or anything, before you even had a chance to operate, your clothes would be literally your pants cut off your body, and they'd give you like a pair of pants to wear home and then send you a check for a new pair of pants. And that's very serious, crapped up. You don't want to get your tools, any radiation on anything that is forever. So it has to be thrown away. So if you have a wrench, a tool, any sort of item that gets touched with radiation, it must be thrown into the garbage. And then that garbage has to be hidden for thousands of years under hundreds of feet of salt mines where it leaks because of fracking. There's an explosion, and then the supposedly impenetrable underground vault is leaking plutonium into the atmosphere. All right, and then the public isn't told about it until they're screaming and yelling, having community meetings, and threatening to go after the government officials, and finally they tell them the truth, and who knows if that's even the truth. So this is, true. I'm not even exaggerating. This is just what happened. I mean, I wish that I was exaggerating and just another lunatic or a crackpot, but this is really happening. So it's one of the most amazing stories, Eucrise, that I've ever followed. All right, so I want to go back in time now, Eutrice. Take a moment. Let's go back 150 years, all right, to an autumn morning in 1858 along a branch of a river called it's not the Columbia, one, a smaller river that maybe runs into the Columbia. A young Indian warrior by the name of Qualchon, probably six others, entered this encampment. The encampment was for a man, one of the first settlers in the Northwest, the first white settlers in the Northwest. His name was Wright, George Wright, Colonel George Wright. And he was given orders, direct orders, to pacify the Indians, the Yakima, Umatilla, the various Indian tribes in that area, the Nez Perce. The Yakima, one of the largest, they had a tremendously large all of central Washington was their territory, all along the river and out into the territory on both sides of the river, the Yakima Indians. And Qualchon had discovered that his father had been taken hostage or prisoner by George Wright, Colonel Wright. So he went to Colonel Wright's encampment. And when he got to Colonel Wright's encampment, he thought, probably thinking that under the Native American style was to take captives and then trade the captives in order for peace, thinking this would be an opportunity to make peace, he entered the encampment with several of his friends and his wife. upon entering the encampment in order to negotiate the release of his father, and under the idea that he was going to be doing that, he was grabbed by the soldiers without even a moment's hesitation, dragged to a tree, and hung, all right, in front of his wife. As his wife said, "We were waiting to progress in making peace with our enemy when two soldiers grabbed my husband about the head and shoulder area and binding his hands with a cord. At first, I thought it was all just a huge trick. But then I saw the preparations they were making and I felt terrified. They hung him, but I managed to get away." The stream where the incident occurred was until 1899 called Hangman's Creek. In 1899, they changed the name to the Indian word Lata, which means Fish Creek. But there's still, if you go by there, a stone spot at a roadside park on the bank of the river where it happened, a few miles from Spokane, Washington. Before the end of that war, many other Native American chiefs were either hung or shot. And at the end of the fighting, the Yakima Nation lost 29,000 square miles of their traditional lands and are now living on a reservation right next to the Hanford nuclear site. Right. In 1943, Colonel Franklin Matthias, who was appointed by Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, to establish a site somewhere, he found Hanford, met with the leader of another group of Indians, the Wanapum Indians, their leader, Johnny Buck. And he promised them that this would only be temporary. They had to leave their lands, their ancestral lands. It would only be temporary, and they would be allowed to freely visit their ancestral graves and sacred sites. However, when they left, they were not allowed behind the fences without guards until just a few years ago. So it was 70 years, actually. And they were hardly ever allowed there, a few times under heavy guard and only recently without guard. Now, I'll mention that. One of the reasons I mention that is the Wanapum Indians have an unusual history. They're a very small group, all right? They have this unique relationship with the federal government. The Wanapum introduced something called the Washat Prophet Dance religion by their leader, whose name was Smohalla, who taught that the Indians should return to their lives before the whites arrived. And following these teachings, when they signed a peace treaty with the whites, the Wanapum refused to sign the treaty, because they wouldn't go along with anything the whites offered, the Europeans, the settlers, whoever, the army. And so therefore, they are never been federally recognized as a tribe. So the main tribe and their communities, White Bluff near Hanford, were the exact area of the river where the reactors were built. That is their land, the Wanapum Indians. Now, what happened was the government has a special relationship with the natives because of this history. And basically, the Wanapum tribe got to reestablish a village next to a dam, the Priest River's Dam, which is one of their sacred fishing sites, which has been totally obliterated by one of these many dams that have been built in Hanford along the Columbia River from the first one back in the 1930s, which is the Grand Coulee Dam, one of the great American massive governmental finance projects of its day of the 1930s. And along in the decades since then, many other dams have been built that produce tremendous amounts of electricity, water power, hydroelectric power, electricity, and provide the water for the irrigation of the lands, the desert lands around Hanford, which are some of the breadbasket of America. I mean, every time you go to the store, you see Washington apples, Washington cherries, Washington everything. Washington State is the reason why we have vegetables all winter long. It's the reason why we have fruit. You can buy fruit at every fruit stand in New York. Why you can get cherries. There's no shortage. They don't grow those cherries here. They grow them along the banks and the orchards along the banks of the Columbia River near Hanford, where they've been watered by waters of the Columbia River for decades. Starting with the Grand Coulee Dam. Now, the Wanapum Dam, named after the Indians, the native people of the area, is about 20 miles north, one of the other dams, 20 miles north of Hanford. And also in February, it's sort of strange, it's almost like all these things happen at once, developed a crack along the bottom of the dam, 65-foot-long dam. It's called a sunny day incident. That means that there was no obvious reason for it. Just one day on a sunny, beautiful day with no pressure on the dam, no, nothing. It was the water was low. There was no storms, no earthquakes, nothing. And all of a sudden, boom, a 65-foot dam crack just like out of nowhere appears across the face of the dam. They immediately had to lower the water level. And I think I mentioned that that's then uncovered these ancient grave sites, which had been a point of contention with the natives for a long time over just how long they've lived there and how they're related to these Indians. And all, many of the legal battles about whether or not you can prove you are the specific descendant of a specific person who's buried in a specific place, it relates to the whole idea of radiation. Can you prove that your cancer came from a specific radiation dose that came at a specific time in a specific place? And only then do you have a right to claim you were injured. All right. Only then do you have a right to claim that ancestor is yours. Right. So, and that has a lot to do how long you live in a place, what, how you relate to the government and how you relate to the locals in that area. And so the Wanapum Dam, it turned out, and you have to, I thank you for this, Utrecht. You sent me some of the recent report that just came out just a few days ago. It was showed that in 1960, when they built that dam, they used incorrect mathematical formulas. And this tells you something about, because I tell you, the engineers who built Hanford, the workers who built these reactors were brilliant. They were geniuses. They did things. People were born in the time of horse and buggies, took us into the space age, and how they were able to do it, I think people will be arguing about that for a long time to come. How was it they were able to figure this stuff out and take us into the space age when they grew up going around on horse and buggies? I don't know. Nobody really knows. It's about, a lot of debate about the whole, you know, about immigration to America and the energy that immigrants bring as opposed to the, you know, us schlumpy folks who just live here. But they definitely, these immigrants who came from Eastern Europe and from Italy and different places were geniuses, and they were able to figure out things that would seem magical, you know, to other people at that time. And Albert Einstein, you know, you have to bow to him. I mean, it's amazing what he was able to discover. I wish we could have done better with it than poisoning our environment for hundreds of years to come with those discoveries. Or
just
using
let me insert
weapons.
Here, Paul, that that information that I forwarded to you was forwarded to me by a listener, Easy, as he calls himself, who had sent that information listening to the first installment and thought it was relevant. So I want to thank him and publicly acknowledge him for that.
Thank you for that, and thank you for the listeners. I couldn't have done this without the listeners. I mean, this is all a case of whistleblowers, observers, residents, local native people. I mean, this is a people's struggle to find out what's going on here, and it has been since the very beginning. So the Wanapum are in this unique relationship because they all get to work on this dam, right? They work on the Priest River Dam. They're all hired by the government. That's the payoff, you know, and listen, they know it's a payoff and they're not happy with it, but you can't say no to a job when the government has taken away your entire livelihood for thousands of years. You have to say yes to the job, and then you're put in the horrible situation of having to keep your mouth shut if you want to keep your job and keep your special relationship with the government. There is a problem there, and there always has been. Also, there's another thing. Here I am talking about the wonderful cherries and fruit and vegetables, the fish, the salmon, the wonderful natural bounty of the Columbia River, the great, one of the richest, most verdant places. I mean, it's desert, and it's still richest and verdant place on Earth. And, you know, I don't want to tell people don't eat the cherries, don't eat the fruit, don't eat the fish from the water. Do you think the people who live there, who have been poisoned by years and years of this experimentation, want me or anybody else to go around and tell them not to buy their products, their livelihood? No way. And I understand that. Who would? All right, who would? Okay, it's a very difficult situation that people have been put in by the government's nuclear weapons program. All right. Rex Buck Jr. is a descendant of the original, a person who was forced to make the deal with the government. He's a spokesperson for the Wanapum. He says the Wanapum's religion teaches that the earth and all nature have a spirit deserving of respect, adding that maybe with a little irony in his voice, I saw this in a video, and I've talked to some of the other native folks there, that after the government came to Hanford, some native land was actually protected because it was in this secret area of 500-600 square miles, surrounded by hundreds of square miles of buffer area that you were not allowed to go into. Huge areas of territory have not been developed or somewhat, you know, untouched. And this area was in 2000 turned into The Hanford Reach National Monument by President Clinton, one of his last acts as president. And it has the last undammed free-flowing section of the Columbia River. So a small but important benefit of Hanford's job as a plutonium production facility has been the protection of traditional wildlife and plants, as well as grave sites of ancestors. This benefit has come at a high price. I spoke with Russell Jim, who is head of the Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Indian Nation's Environmental Restoration and Waste Management Program. The most important issue to the Yakima Nation, he says, is protection and respect for treaty reserved rights. The Treaty of 1855 that ended the Yakima's war with the whites guarantees the nation the right to fish, hunt, and gather foods and medicines in a large area of central and eastern Washington that was part of the original Yakima territory. But those rights are being violated every day. Think of this. Plumes of radioactive groundwater are just 400 yards from the river where the tribe accesses the Hanford Reach Monument, according to those treaty rights. The plumes are underground rivers of radioactive waste and toxic chemicals flowing steadily toward the river and into the river for years, decades. Standard waste, Hanford waste, was poured into wells and dirt trenches. There was underground lakes of cancer-causing isotopes like strontium and cesium. There have been seeping into the river dozens of what they call springs along the banks for decades. And we'll be getting in, when we talk about the end reactor, we'll be talking about springs. Russell Jim says the Department of Energy wants to redefine – this is interesting. He says that what the DOE wants to do is redefine Hanford's waste as low activity, defined by the EPA as concentrations of radioactive particles small enough that they may not require all of the radiation protection measures necessary for higher-level waste. Therefore, they can cut costs. They can bury it in shallow pits instead of really deep, high-tech pits that cost a fortune to build and dig. Right. What Jim says is that very little is known about radiation. So how do we know if this is low activity is like better? They give it a name. It's low activity waste. What does that mean? No, but that's an artificial definition. It's like low activity waste, low activity death in a way, you know, that's what it is to a lot of people. All right. So to back up my statement, a recent study done for the Yakima Nation found that Native Americans near Hanford have a 1 in 50 chance of developing cancers in excess of the normal cancer rate. I spoke with anthropologist Stuart E. Walker, Jr., who wrote a report that concluded that traditional Native people consuming fish, plants, and medicines along the river were exposed to much greater amounts of radiation than other residents. The groundbreaking study that they wrote combines ethnographic research of fishing practices during the years of Hanford's operations with studies of fish consumption to estimate the radiation doses received by Yakima people living along the Columbia. The researchers were allowed rare access to officially recorded fishing areas. And since salmon is crucial to Native culture and the condition of salmon in the declining numbers on the Columbia River are an indicator for environmentalists and local residents on the health of the river. So, I wanted to tell you, but I might have to leap over it, some stuff about the archaeological history. It's pretty amazing. I got a good lecture. I have to say the Hanford folks, the folks who run Hanford, Bechtel, run an excellent museum called the Beat Reactor, where that was the first reactor built at Hanford. And I got to go visit it in October. So I was taken out to the Beat Reactor where I stepped out of the – I was in front of the reactor. I wanted to take a picture. They told us stay on the asphalt of the parking lot. We drove through the security gates and through the desert. I saw the animals there, which they are said to like be radioactive, and their droppings. If they get off the reservation and take a poop on your land, you have to call radiation disposal people to clean it up. The animal's poop is radioactive. As well as they had a big problem with the tumbleweed was radioactive, and so they had to collect it all, and then it would treat it like nuclear waste. You couldn't just burn it. Right, so they have all these kind of problems, right? So I'm stepping back, and I wanted to get the whole reactor building in my frame, so I step one foot off of that asphalt, and they start screaming at me, get off the asphalt. And I'm really afraid now of that foot. You know, I stepped on the dirt for a second. Who knows what was there? All right, why they were screaming at me. You never know, right? They tell you one thing, and then why do they scream at you for stepping 1 foot on the dirt if they tell you, oh, it's not so bad. So we after that safety talk, we entered about what to do if the alarm goes off and all kinds of things like that. We entered the reactor, that place where it was done. And we had great tour guides. They really know this, knew their stuff. They told us about how the aluminum cans that held the uranium fuel were fed into channels as we stood there in front of the reactor face. It towered 40 feet above us, bristling with pipes. And after weeks of being irradiated by neutrons, the uranium ejected through the back of the reactor, glowing an eerie blue at the bottom. My dad, who was, you know, was a Hanford engineer. He didn't work at Hanford, but he was often there back in the 1960s, early 60s. He said he actually saw it in the end reactor. He actually was allowed in the back where it came out. Usually you weren't allowed in the back where the high radiation was. And it would pop out the back. When you pushed through the front, the stuff that was already in there for 6 weeks would be pushed out the back and it would fall into a pool of water. And the water is usually enough to shield the radiation. Just you got to make sure there's always water there. And it's an amazing sight to see a piece of metal begin to turn translucent and transparent and glow with an eerie blue light. That's what happens when things become, when plutonium becomes highly radioactive. You know, when uranium is enriched and it becomes highly, you know, full of plutonium metal atoms. And it literally almost becomes clear. You can see into it and it glows a very eerie blue light that fills the whole room with light. And that's one of the more amazing things that occurs that people see when, with your own eyes, you can see when something becomes radioactive. It would then sit at the bottom of the storage pool. I got to go inside the control room and see the big Bakelite knobs, the old-fashioned 1940s controls, the scram button that you would push to stop in an emergency to stop the reactor if it started to, like, overreact, which is called going supercritical, which is really bad. It could lead to a meltdown, like happened at Fukushima. A loss of water, either from the storage pool or the reactor, could be catastrophic. The fuel would melt into a radioactive molten mass, right? There were inlets for river water to cool the reactor. They were no longer used. This is a museum now. They cut them off, but to this day, Russian inspectors come every year and inspect to make sure that somehow the B reactor hasn't been secretly restarted as a plutonium-producing reactor. Both the United States and Russia, since the fall of the Soviet Union, have sent inspectors to the nuclear sites of both countries to inspect to make sure that they have not, either country has not started making plutonium again. That's a sure sign that there's trouble in the world. If either the United States or Russia, it would be both, because if one did it, the other would, started manufacturing plutonium again, that's a sign, a political, social sign of serious problems between the two countries. And something to really watch out for. All right, if you ever hear that happening, you know there's trouble. Okay, serious trouble, much more serious than what's happening in Ukraine. All right, so... and they inspect each other. And so if they cut off those inspections, they don't start allowing people not to inspect. Like there were certain threats that were made in the last few months over the Ukraine thing. Those are dangerous, warlike moves by whoever says that. After sitting on the pool for weeks, the fierce initial radiation subsided. The uranium was loaded onto a lead-lined railway car, which was pulled along a track to the tea plant for plutonium recovery. We boarded our tour bus, and we were among the first people allowed to see the facility which had just been opened to the public, the tea plant. That's where they actually took the plutonium out of the uranium. I noticed deer bouncing along the desert as we turned down the road, and we came to the tea plant, which is called the Canyon, by the workers, because it's high processing walls, 43 massive chemical processing cells. It's also called the Queen Mary, because it resembles the cruise ship sitting on land in the middle of a flat plain. It's 900 feet long. It processed the plutonium for the Fat Man bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki and the Trinity test. The Hiroshima bomb was a uranium bomb. It was made of highly enriched uranium, and that was produced at another location. We're not even talking about that because it's how much can you talk about in 1 hour, as we know, Utrice, in a place called in Tennessee, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And you notice that both places were near big dams. Oak Ridge was built near the Tennessee Valley Authority dams, and Hanford near the recently built Grand Coulee Dam. So, you know, and the Grand Coulee Dam, for example, when it was built, was considered a white elephant because there was no place to use the electricity. The 900-foot-long structure is where it happened. It was progressively more advanced methods were employed by chemists. And the earliest method, the dirtiest of them all, was called the bismuth phosphate process. And I talked to a 92-year-old Steve Buckingham, who worked there then, he was one of the tour guides, and he said it was wartime. He says radioactive iodine was released in large brown clouds of acidic gas as buckets of irradiated uranium was dumped into the first cell. He said the scale, well, you have to realize that 2 years earlier, Glenn Seaborg had made a microscopic sample of plutonium, and that was a great discovery. 2 years later, they were making a million times that. He said it was the biggest scale-up he could think of in American in world human history, that they could go from 1 to 1 million doing the same process 1 million times bigger and within 2 years. You have to give these people credit. I don't know why they were doing it. What motivated? Fear of the Nazis, fear of the Japanese. I don't know what it was. A desire, some of them, for to have the ultimate weapon, that America should have the ultimate, most destructive weapon and could control the world, and this would be for the good of the world. These are all the reasons. People, most people didn't even know what they were doing. They were just, it was classified. If they asked, they would say classified. That would be the end of it. It was amazing, he said, what they were able to do. Crane operators in lead-lined cabs behind a concrete wall could thread a needle. It had to, since the process cells with their 5-foot-thick walls were too radioactive to enter, and all the work had to be done remotely. The tea plant was producing plutonium less than a year after groundbreaking in October. Can you believe that? In less than a year, they made their first amount of plutonium. They were producing plutonium. The most time-consuming part of the project was the 3-month job of digging the immense foundation. By February 44, they were doing cold runs of non-irradiated uranium to test the process. 2 months later, the first batch was on its way to Los Alamos to be turned into a bomb. When I was there, the building had a really strange smell, a smell of death, I thought. I couldn't place it. And I asked the workers about it, and they just looked at me with almost terror in their face. They didn't want to answer. They don't know what's in the building, and they work there, and it's supposed to be clean. Today, it's used by Hanford workers to repackage plutonium-containing uniforms, machines, scrap that was dug up at Hanford for eventual reburial. Huge amounts. At the WIP, the Weist Isolation Pilot Plant deep in the New Mexico salt mine. That's where it's supposed to go. It's not going anywhere now after what happened in WIP. After 12 years. I always say 12 years. It's supposed to last 250,000 years. It made it 12 years. Okay, we headed back to Richland through the heart of Hanford where I saw, now this is the key thing we have to think about for today, Utrecht, the waste treatment plant where Hanford's millions of gallons of waste is supposed to be rendered safe for storage. Known as the vitrification plant, from the Latin word for glass, because the waste is to be transformed to a stable glass-like material. Construction of the partially built behemoth was stopped months ago. I'm talking about now, today, and it was just a few months ago that they stopped all construction for safety reasons. $12 billion have already been spent on the pit plant. It was supposed to be working now, converting the waste into glass. But the private contractors building the plant for the DOE have announced it will cost another $12 billion more at least and 10 more years. That's talk about overrun. That is the biggest overrun in history. I've never heard of an overrun like that. $12 billion overrun and 10 more years to do it beyond what they promised they would do 10 years ago. Several Hanford employees have testified. I mean, it is one after another. You can see the testimonies on C-SPAN has them on their website. They were before Congress just a few weeks ago. They've testified to the fact that the vitrification process is unsafe and unworkable. As I watched a massive plant in the distance, it resembled really the carcass of a great extinct animal lying dead on the desert floor. I mean, that's what it looked like to me. Later that night, because I was there that weekend, right, in October, for the 70th anniversary, I attended a lecture in Richland given by Richard Rhodes, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb. I was really happy to meet him. I've read 3 of his books now. Rhodes believes that the era of nuclear weapons that began at Hanford 70 years earlier is entering its twilight. Nuclear weapons have no true military purpose. Understand that. They are not military weapons. The reason Hitler did not develop atom bombs, Hitler said it himself, I don't see the purpose of it. He wanted to conquer countries, wanted to conquer territory and move German people into those territories to expand his country. He couldn't see why you would want to destroy and render it uninhabitable for thousands of years. Do that. He didn't see the purpose of it. And in that one thing, like worst miserable excuse of a human being in the course of human history, Adolf Hitler was right about, was that, and he was right, that nuclear weapons have no true military purpose. They were not built. They are weapons of terrorism. How could you have a military purpose if it would invariably lead to the destruction of both warring sides? If both sides are going to be wiped out, what's the military purpose? The bombs already used to end World War II were noble in Rhodes' view, which I totally disagree with, because they quickly ended a war that seemed to have no end. However, Russia doesn't pose the same threat, and never did, and neither does the Soviet Union really pose a threat. Russia definitely not the same threat. And proliferation and possibly nuclear terrorism remain dangerous problems facing the world. Rhodes asserts that it's time for nuclear nations to disarm. There is no reason not to disarm. Before leaving Hanford were Rhodes' words in my mind. I drove in my rental, which I finally began to master. If you remember, when I first arrived, I was pulled over because I couldn't figure out how to turn the rear lights on a separate switch or something in this little car. I drove in my rental, which I finally began to master, to the Hanford Reach Monument, stopping at a pullout on a bluff overlooking the river and the Hanford site below. The view would have been top secret and photos strictly prohibited as little as 20 years ago. The reactor is mostly sealed up and waiting demolition in another 75 years as their lingering radioactivity cools, stand alone against the desert, stripped of the miles of high-tension power lines, coolant pump houses, and other industrial remnants of the time when the United States raced to produce thousands of tons of an element with little use besides suicidal war. How do we get to this? What's next? Who pays? Those are the subjects of my next articles in this series of America's Desert, in this series on America's Desert Graveyard, where the ghosts of the past refuse to stay buried.
Wow, that was quite riveting, Paul. One thing I wanted to ask you, which is current, there has been a development as recently as last week. What was it?
What's happening, I can switch to the what's been happening is that the government, there's a plan back after this came out, after the truth of Hanford, which had been kept secret until 1986, came out, all right, people began to finally get these, because of Karen Dornsteel and her reports in the Spokane News, which are among the great, great examples of 20th and 21st century journalism. You know, Karen Dornsteel from a small paper in a small town in a remote corner of America did some of the greatest reporting in American history. All right. She was the one who dug this stuff up. All of this was secret. It was top secret classified. You could get arrested and thrown in prison for the rest of your life for talking about this. All right. And Snowden, WikiLeaks, all that stuff are nothing compared to this. And Hanford environmental cleanup formally began in May of 1989 with the signing of the so-called tri-party agreement that sets requirements and deadlines for the cleanup of the waste. All right. The tri-party agreement, which has a rule of law, and the three parties are the stakeholders, are the local citizens, the state, and the federal government. Right. And they have a quasi-governmental body called the Advisory Council, of which I have several people I know have been interviewed are members of the Advisory Council and tell me what's going on there. And since 1989, they began the work of trying to clean it up. And in some ways, they've been successful. Visibly, when you go to Hanford, as I think I just described, it looks amazingly clean. The surf superficially, when you look over it, the river, the stuff has been moved back from the river or destroyed or demolished, or if the case can't be demolished, it's too radioactive, it's been sealed, cocooned, they call it. The radioactive stuff, huge amounts of it are being slowly but surely moved, dug up from where it was just dumped for 40, 70 years, and moved to specially designed dumps in the middle of and near the tank farms, which still contain the 60 million gallons of tanks of radioactive waste. The problem is those tanks are leaking. At least 60 of the tanks are leaking today. And I tell you, I talked to somebody who was there in 59 to 1963 working on the N reactor, and they told me that they were taken on a walk by one of the scientists who worked there, who lived there, and the person who told me this said he wanted to punch this person in the mouth because they were laughing about how it was leaking into the river back then, 55 years ago, It was leaking that and laughing about it. It was the biggest joke that, right, oh, we're standing right on top of it. They got rivers of this stuff. It's just leaking into the river. And the person who heard this story, this guy's laughing at it, wanted to shut him up with a punch in the mouth because he knew how dangerous that was. And how could somebody have such a light-hearted approach to this? You know, how could they laugh about it? It's not a joke. You know, and any engineer and scientist knows it's not a joke. All right, this thing has been leaking from the day it started. So now they have 177 tanks. A number of them were the single-shelled World War II era tanks that are like no tanks at all. And then they tried to move the stuff from those tanks into newer tanks that were built in the 60s through the 80s called double-shell tanks, which are supposed to not leak, even though so much time has gone by are coming to the end of their lives. They are beyond the end of their working engineered lifespans. And they're leaking all over the place. And then the most recent thing was the 26 workers, it wasn't even radioactive. Just the chemical, non-radioactive chemical will destroy your lungs. One little whiff and your life and health are ruined forever. One whiff, there's no like, oh, I just got one whiff. No, it's over. Your lungs are destroyed. Right? You're sick for the rest of your life. There's things that these chemicals do to your body that is totally not understood. Nobody has any idea what they do to you. They just know it's deadly. All right? 26 workers were dosed. And then with radioactive, and then the government hit it again. This is just months ago. And they did this. And then after they tell us, oh, we're transparent. We're going to tell you the truth. We know every, you know, you'll know everything as soon as we know it. Turned out that we didn't know it. If it wasn't for very intrepid people on the Hanford Advisory Council, if it wasn't for people like Hanford Watch, Tom Carpenter, if it wasn't for like the union, that Hanford Atomic Workers, Metal Workers Union, if it wasn't for these people, if it wasn't for the Cold War patriots, 92-year-old people who think it was the greatest thing they ever did in their lives making these things, who are now suffering, right? Because you can live to be 94 and have a better life than you would have if you didn't breathe in radiation. Right, 40 years ago, or 50 years ago, or 60 or 70 years ago, and they put a lot of pressure, you know, and it came out that the government was hiding the fact that people had sucked in this stuff, and they were badly injured. 26 workers just recently, just a few weeks ago, and again, the key thing is the government kept it a secret until people found out and dragged it out of them.
You know, well, I know you're going to be reporting again on, you know, this is going to be an ongoing story. It's been very, very illuminating and scary at the same time. But, you know, there is a narrative here that isn't entirely surprising. The fact that these locations were chosen for specific reasons, the people who were displaced and most harmed by the actions of the government, the lies and deceit of the government, the enormity of the impact of this catastrophe that has yet to dominate the conversation in the United States. And I know we'll learn a lot more. So thanks so much for bringing this to our attention. How do people keep pace with your reports, Paul?
You're my outlet right now. I've written a few things, but I'm really, I don't want them to go everywhere all at once. I want them to go through, and I love going through this show and being able to read and tell this stuff to your listeners. So your listeners, you trees, are the ones who are going to find it out first. Other than that, my website, my YouTube site where I put videos about this and other issues is youtube.com/letemtalk, LETEMTALK. And one interesting video I did with several of the Hanford downwinders, which has my photographs and films from my visit to Hanford, is also available there at that site. And you can get it by going to YouTube and just going, my name is Paul DiRienzo, DiRienzo, and type in Hanford downwinders. And you'll see the video interviews with Tom Bailey and some of the other folks from Hanford who I met while I was there.
And we'll be hearing their voices soon, too. Paul, yeah. I want to thank you also for choosing this as your debut to the Lead Stories audience, bringing this information to them and first to them. This is a great honor for us in this program to have
offer us this
exclusive look at this incredible story. Thank you so much again, and we'll be with each other again soon. Next week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today, and I hope there was something in there that you found of value. Just let me know. Write me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Hugh Therese Lead. I really do appreciate hearing from you. Keep it right here. Coming up next is, let's see what's coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. I want to thank you for listening, because this is a learning session. We were in class, if it didn't occur to you. That's really what it was. It's more listening and learning. The time will certainly come when we open it up for all kinds of questions. But for the first part of these discussions, it is more about listening and learning about something that is happening of enormous impact to the entire country. And it is off the shelf. It's not part of the conversation, and yet everybody, literally everybody, is affected. It is as grave as, and some people say even worse than, if you could even compare things like that, than Fukushima. It is America's Fukushima. Thanks so much for being with me today. See you tomorrow, and pass the word that PRN and this very program are your very favorite places to go for information.